In a world where political disclosure has been reduced to poking each other in the eye on social media, you found the one place where a voice of reason rises above the bullshit. Welcome to That's What You Think, the podcast that finds the hypocrisy of American politics and kicks it squarely in the crank, with your host, America's favorite balding, middle-aged, pear-shaped economist, Pete Mento.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the inaugural edition of the That's What You Think podcast. I know we've had a lot of names that have been bandied about, and Jesus Christ, I had absolutely no idea what the fuck we were going to call this thing from the very beginning, but this is what we landed on. And why are we calling it That's What You Think? Well, a couple of reasons, but probably the biggest one is it seems like we're all stuck right now as a society, in America at least, and I'm just speaking for the country I live in. Christ's sakes, I want American. I'm looking at where we are, and I see that we're also beat up because each and every one of us is so stuck with what we believe. We're very sure of what we think we know. And this last election was awful. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and every other goddamn social media thing you can think of. And it was almost comical to see again and again people saying, I'm going to be off Facebook until after the election. I'm blocking this person. I'm blocking this other person. One of my closest friends, almost a neighbor of mine, blocked me because he was sick and tired of seeing all of my libertarian rants, which, you know, I've got to admit, I'm an entertaining motherfucker. So that was sort of a punishment in and of itself, not having access to my brilliance. But the point I'm trying to make is that there seems to be this need for people to rush off to a place where they don't have to engage anymore, where so much of our discourse politically and our discourse about things that are going on around us, they tend to be happening in these echo chambers where we create this box for ourselves where we're really only hearing the things that back up what we believe. We're really only taking in opinions and attitudes that agree with the things that we want them to agree with. And that seemed like bullshit to me. So as the election happened and the outcome of President-elect Trump coming to fruition, which still, I mean, I think I'm having some kind of a fucking acid flashback every time I say that. I had this realization that there needs to be some sort of a throwback to when people actually talk to each other. I've got teenagers. I have four children. And the older ones don't like to talk to people. We go to restaurants. I have to tell them to look the waiter in the eye and tell him or her what they want because they're so used to being behind a keyboard and communicating through the clickety-clack of their thumbs. It's real easy to be a badass behind a keyboard. It's real simple through social media to stand there and to be the mighty Thor of a social warrior when you realize that no one's going to look you dead in the eye when you have that conversation, when there is no back and forth, when we can put our ideas and our arguments into a written format and edit them and put them out there, have moments to think them over. And then for the peanut gallery to sit there and like what we say or hate what we say. And that's why we're ending up turning into this society of people that feel like we can treat each other like we're Yelp reviews. So I came out of that election saying to myself, what we need is a safe place about as much as we need a good swift kick in the nuts. This will not be a safe place. I'm in my 40s and I can remember going to high school in Manchester, New Hampshire, live for your die, grant a state for life, 603 motherfuckers. And all of us getting together in Mrs. Durkee's chemistry class to watch the space shuttle launch in Manchester, New Hampshire. Because, of course, we had a teacher from Concord, New Hampshire, who was on the Challenger. And it blew up. I mean, it blew up. It was a tragedy. It was an awful national tragedy. And I can remember that we all went back to class. And a very brief prayer was said. But then we went on to our next class and our next class. And then we went home. And my parents and I talked about it briefly. And the next day we went to school. And although it was a topic of discussion, they didn't give us any counselors to talk about it. They didn't, They didn't say, if you guys need to sit down and have a brief chat about what you just saw yesterday, we're going to have a quiet room over here where you can collect your thoughts. We were expected to process it through our peer group. We were expected to talk to our teachers if we wanted to, but it was something that we dealt with at home. There wasn't a safe space. My safe space was sitting in my living room with my mom and dad, or more likely sitting in my bedroom with my headphones on, stoned out of my mind, listening to David Bowie. But it certainly wasn't a place where I feel like I could have some kind of a therapy session. So I look at where we are now, where we have to tiptoe around everybody's feelings, where we've created an entire industry where people's opinions can be either lauded or trashed at a moment's notice, where cyberbullying and something that could be so fantastically useful is turning instead into a tool where everyone's bullshit opinion can be flown from sea to shining sea. And it's funny that, you know, an egotistical, self-centered prick like myself would say something like that as I'm sitting here in front of a laptop with a microphone, honestly doing basically the same thing. Like, my opinions are any more valuable? Well, you know, fuck you, maybe they are. But I have a lot of interesting friends. I have a really bizarre cast of characters from all the years that I've spent on the road lecturing, whether it's talking about international trade and the economy, talking about terrorism and cyber terrorism, talking about politics, or just doing comedy. And when I looked at my social media, I saw how rich and interesting people's attitudes were when they really did want to talk. And I decided, enough. We're going to have a podcast where I'm going to bring people in to have a real conversation about things where I don't necessarily agree with anything that they have to believe in, but we're going to have a conversation about it, and I'm going to respect their opinions and they're going to respect mine. And at the end of it, we're going to have a high five and probably a shot of wild turkey. And I don't intend to change anybody's minds, but we're going to talk about it like adults. And there's probably going to be some funny ha-ha in there as well. So why do we call it That's What You Think? Because that might be your opinion, but hopefully over the course of the 45 minutes or so that we do have these shows, maybe you'll learn something new. Maybe there's something about what you hear from myself or from my guests that makes you take a different look at things. If nothing else, it'll give you something to do while you're driving to work. So we just had an election, and a lot of you suffered through just an endless torrent of bullshit through social media, fake news, real news, just real bad comments from that jerk off Tom at work who puts all kinds of bad memes up on his social media pages. But I think what really came out of the end of it was a lot of arguments about who should have won, who is your president, who's not your president, and all that other horseshit. And the topic of today's podcast is really twofold. One, the election. And second of all, do we still really need to do elections the way that we have for so long? I mean, we live in 2017. We live in an era where I can vote for American Idol on a telephone, but I can't vote for the people that I want to be in Congress or the Senate. I can do a deposit of a paycheck from my phone from a picture for thousands of dollars, but the government doesn't trust me through that same type of technology to tell you who I want to be the dog catcher and on town council. That seems ridiculous. And why is it that in this day and age where I can go from one side of the country to the other and back again in the same day, we're not giving people more days to vote? We're not allowing them, given the richness of our lives and how different things are, to be able to vote over a whole week. Why have we thought about different ways to get people more involved in the electoral process instead of keeping them out? And this caused a lot of debate amongst my friends, particularly on the political side of things. So I started asking people who don't necessarily agree with me on this topic, because I've always believed that we should go to a popular vote for president. I didn't see or understand what the whole goddamn point was of the Electoral College. And this was a departure for me, because I have a unholy, like, corpse man crush on Alexander Hamilton. The guy's an economist, you know, he was a prick bastard. No one really cared for him. He had pretty rough opinions, but he was generally right. I see a lot of myself in that guy. And I ended up talking to some friends of mine who pointed out that one of the reasons Electoral College really backs up with a lot of what I believe in are some of the real problems in America. I think that a lot of what's going on in this country, a lot of what's making it more and more difficult for us to find some kind of middle ground comes a lot more from economic disparity than it does racism, than it does religion, than it does gender. And I think a lot of the differences in who we are have more to do with where we live. And this is an important distinction about where we live than who we live around. So let me give you some more insight about that. I'm an interesting case study in geography. Up until very recently, I lived in an incredibly small town in the Northeast in, I guess, southwestern New Hampshire called Mason. And it's the size of a postage stamp. I lived on 85 acres in a 6,000 square foot brick farmhouse. And the town that we lived in had less than 1,000 people in it. That existence for me was fabulous because as a misanthrope and someone who, although is involved in sales, really fucking hates people, it allowed me to have this insular lifestyle where I could scream at Fox News and clean my guns and walk around in my underwear and my cowboy boots and honestly be as disavowed from society as I wanted to be and live this sort of agrarian lifestyle on my farm. But because it was becoming so insular, it was very difficult for my family to live there. And because of what I do for a living and because I do work so closely with the government, it made a lot of sense for me professionally to move to Washington, D.C. So we made the decision not to live in the district and instead to move to Northern Virginia. And this was a wholesale, unbelievably crazy, big fucking change. I mean, massive fucking change. We went from living in all the space. And it was like living in a national park where we were to living in a gated community on a golf course in a big new house, you know, that was designed for convenience. We live in a town where someone basically dropped a Target and then put all kinds of retail around that Target and then built communities around the retail. It's like this economic American dream of if you build it, they will come. If you create this center to spend money you don't have on shit you don't need, that they will come to it out of convenience. And when you're a guy who's lived 25 minutes away from the closest grocery store in a town that had a gas station and a Dunkin' Donuts, this was incredible to me. I can drive a third of a mile and be at an incredible grocery store. I can go to the movies in about 5 minutes. So what's different though is, although I lived out in the sticks, I still worked in Boston. Before that, I lived in the city in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Before that, I lived in a small fishing community. And the point I'm trying to make is when I moved from New Hampshire to Virginia, I went from a town where people didn't talk to each other. I went from a town where you didn't engage with one another. I did what I did. My neighbors did what they did. And again, live free or die. It was important that we didn't interact with one another. People would have thought I was fucking strange if I went knocking on the doors and asked how their day was, or, you know, if you did eye contact for too long, it might end up in a goddamn gunfight. But now I live in a town where the community is important, and the things that matter to them are not the same things that mattered when I lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or when I lived in downtown Boston, as an example. What matters to these communities is almost on the opposite side of the spectrum. I live in a town where going to church and then having a cup of coffee afterwards with the people you go to church with matters, where the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts matter, where local sports teams are more than a tradition. They're an important part of the social scene. And most of what you do as an individual revolves around downtown and Main Street. It revolves around the small clubs. People are very proud of the fact that they're members of the Elks, that they're Masons. It is a feeling of community. And you can't be invisible in a small town where there's a feeling of community. I never once in the entire time that I lived in New Hampshire, and this is someone who makes their money dealing in politics, I never once met a single person on my town council. Not one. face to face. I mean, I went to some council meetings, but I never shook a hand. I never had anybody knock on my door and ask me for the vote, probably afraid they'd get shot. But the point is now I'm constantly inundated with people in the local political set who are interested in my opinions. And it's not because I'm me. It's just because they know that in this town, in this format, in this more rural area, it matters. So when I look at the Electoral College, what does one thing have to do with another? Get to the fucking point, Pete. When you look at the way that the map broke down in this last election, what you're going to see is that a number of the victories for Mr. Trump were centered around more rural communities, and a number of the ones that were for Mrs. Clinton were in clearly large city centers. And I think that not enough attention is paid to the fact that there are very much two Americas. And they're not necessarily based on race. They're not necessarily based entirely on economic indicators, but they're also based on geography. What matters to a farmer in Minnesota, things like corn subsidies and things like how the EPA is going to treat certain sorts of issues with agriculture, like fertilizers, like pesticides. People in New York don't care, but that has a tremendous amount of influence on the financial decisions that these farmers are going to make. People in rural America might not necessarily care about arts education to the same extent. And in a homogenous community where everyone is the same color, I hate to say it, but they might not necessarily pay as much mind to issues of race. And of course, we have to throw some conversations about religion in there as well. In a small community, the church becomes one of the most important centers for social interaction. I don't know if that's necessarily the case in cities. I wasn't able to do enough research to find that out, but I can tell you as a guy who's both religious and lived in a city, I never saw churches that had fewer people than when I lived downtown. So it's a big change. Growing up in Manchester, being in New Hampshire when I was a teenager, my entire worldview about what was cool came from MTV. You know, the clothes that we could wear that the same kids were wearing in New York and LA, I got to see that because it was on MTV, where 4 or 5 years before then, that would not have been a window to the world I would have seen. New music would have come to me if somebody would have happened to have had a chance to go to a record store in New York and brought it back. I'm desperately into hip-hop music. And I found out about great new rap music because I would go visit my father down in New Jersey. I'd walk into a Sam Goody and I would buy every single hip-hop record I could. I didn't even know what they were. I didn't know who the artists were. I would just buy the record and I'd bring it back. And hopefully it was good. If it wasn't, it wasn't. But the entire point was that I needed to consume as much of it as I could because I couldn't find anywhere I lived. It's not the case anymore. This attitude that people live out in the sticks or country bumpkins, it's simply not the case. The answer to practically every question you could have is sitting in your pocket. And moreover, if you want to have a window to any culture, an idea about it, if you want to understand fashions and trends, it's all available on the internet. And because of things like Instagram, pictures of what's happening around the world and the way that fashions are changing are in front of you as well. But culturally, the things that move these smaller communities, those remain steadfast. And I think that people do still vote with that in mind. So the Electoral College has a pretty big part to do with not only how the president is elected, but I think also in how they won, but also it shows a very disparate difference between what's important to us as Americans. And that's why I'm pretty excited to dedicate the first podcast to this particular issue. And, you know, while we're on that, I think it's important to mention also that people keep saying that Donald Trump isn't their president. Like him, dislike him, hate him, whatever the case may be, the guy won the contest that we had. Yes, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but that's not the contest we were having. You know, that's like saying that you threw a football the farthest in the home run derby. No one gives a shit. That's not what the contest was. We have to give credit to the Trump campaign for doing something that is going to legitimately be research for the ages. That win was positively incredible, and it was a tremendous chess match. And some of the things that were done to win it were positively brilliant. And there was a lot of things that had to happen along with it that we can get into when our guests arrive today that made that happen as well regarding who came to vote and who didn't. But it did happen. So yeah, you got a president now. We're going to go over a lot of different subjects and a lot of different ideas through this podcast. We're going to talk a lot about things that you might not necessarily like. What you have to fucking keep in mind is they're just words. And that's the problem. They're just words. They're my opinions. They're not the opinions of the company I work for, my partners. They're not the opinions of my fiance. They're not the opinions of the kids that are unfortunate enough to have to share my home. They're just things that I think. And the things that I think are mine, I get to have them, whether you like them or not. And if that's something that bothers you, that's your fucking problem. But the best I can hope for is that maybe we can find some way to share these ideas so that at least you can understand where I'm coming from and I can understand where you're coming from and we can have a little more respect for each other. So we're going to talk about some things that might make you feel uncomfortable. Things like, as an example, race. Things like the wage gap. We're going to talk about guns. We're going to talk about jobs and the exportation of those jobs and free trade, which I happen to know a thing or two about. We're going to talk about these ideas like how religion fits in American politics and immigration, because it's about time that we were able to talk about them civilly without someone pointing at me and saying, you're a racist just because I don't necessarily agree with your politics, which is so childish. Because it's time that we were able to have that dialogue again. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope that we manage together to find some way to find some middle ground, and I hope it's entertaining. And, you know, with that, we're going to get to our next segment, which is our open letter. And this week, it's an open letter to President Trump. Dear President Trump, I'm sure you'll never read this because, let's face it, I'm just some failed, balding, middle-aged, pear-shaped economist. He's a failed stand-up comic talking into some metal microphone by himself with his pants off in his basement. But you're the most powerful man on the planet. So congratulations on your victory. And I got to tell you, it was probably one of the most contentious and vicious presidential campaigns of my lifetime. But, you know, also, it was one of the most impressive strategies that I'm sure that any of us have ever seen. It's not a stretch at all to say that your campaign was probably going to be something that'll be studied for the ages. And along the way, there were a lot of awful things said about you, about your opponent, about America and the people who live in it. You were called everything from deplorables to racists. And there were times when you acted more like a fucking frat guy than a billionaire businessman. But in any case, you won. And we can all sit here and pass judgment on your past. And trust me, we will. But today, we're going to turn a page. And today, we're going to talk about the future. God knows we need to. So I want you to know that this isn't the America of the 1980s or the 1990s. This is an age of incredible transparency. And you have to come to grips with the fact that as much as you can use information in the media to get your message out, we will be using it to follow every single fucking thing you do, say, ponder, and consider. This goes for your staff, your friends, your wife, and your children too. Like it or not, you're under the microscope, and most of the people observing you really, really, really don't care for you. You can't hide from scrutiny. You won't be able to say one thing and do another, and the leaks and hacking that ruin the chances of your opponent pulling a ruse over eyes will be just as available to ruin your presidency. So step carefully. Your claim to be brutally honest, the best thing you could do is actually act that way. It makes it easier to avoid being caught in a lie to begin with. So in that way, it could be refreshing. You made some really big promises, and I just want to go over a few, at least from my perspective. The wall. Like a friend of mine is fond of saying, you can't have a nation if you don't have borders, and I can agree with that. And if you want to use our national resources and political capital to do that, it's your choice. Your most ardent supporters are going to demand you do. But I'll tell you this much. It isn't going to stop anybody who really wants to from sneaking in. Anybody that wants it badly enough, it may slow them down for now, but walls and other physical barriers are only a step in the direction of total security. Things like electronic surveillance, human intelligence, and continuing to foster a great economy in Mexico will keep people from sneaking into this country. It's like my grandmother said, you know, if you're getting fed well at home and getting banged there, you're not going to find some other place to go get food and sex. The same can be said for economic opportunity. You'll do all that by continuing to build great trade relationships and refining NAFTA, not scrapping it. If you try and deport every Mexican living in the U.S. under questionable circumstances, you're going to have a real problem. In case you didn't notice, you won the Electoral College at the popular vote. If you start to kick in doors at night and drag people into trucks to cart them off to Mexico with their children, you're going to have people like me locked and loaded and willing to die to stop you. And I'm not kidding. I'm willing to die overseeing people sent to camps. And I'm not the only one. There's a better way. To steal a phrase you really love, I know it, you know it, everybody knows it. So find a compromise and use guys like little Marco to get it. You're a rich white guy. You need to build a coalition with actual minorities because your heart's in the right place and your words reflect the right tone when you talk about poverty in our cities and economic opportunities for minorities. You just come off like a real asshole when you do it since, you know, you go back to your house where you literally sit on a golden toilet to take a shit afterwards. Very few people are going to get the chance to make changes at the level of magnitude that you're about to. And in my lifetime, nobody has gotten a chance that didn't owe anybody a favor in D.C. So make taxes simple. Resist the temptation to cave into the wealthy and their intense desire to make themselves even richer for greed's sake. You were elected by angry people who haven't seen real upward mobility in two generations. And you were opposed by people who haven't seen it maybe ever. Bernie Sanders struck a real chord with Americans because everyone feels like they aren't equitable. Remember that. Nobody ever is going to feel like they all got everything they wanted regarding the tax burden. But the wealthiest amongst us can afford to bitch about it in our gated communities and our Range Rovers. Give a little pain to us, but nothing but love to the middle class, and leave the poor alone. I mean, stick it to the fucking bankers, right? They have it coming. Hell, you already hate them to begin with. It ought to be fun for you. Find a way to explain how reducing the corporate income tax to 15% brings U.S. companies back to this country. And it seems like you're doing that now. So kudos to you. But the complex distribution of transfer pricing is a hard thing for common voters to understand. But it shouldn't be. Just show them how 10 of the largest U.S. companies that pay zero U.S. income tax are getting away with it and why they don't. Then show them how they would be and how it wouldn't be a burden to these corporations if they did, or their shareholders, which many of these people happen to be because of 401ks. Next, you could work on fixing our infrastructure. Rebuild our bridges, our ports, our airports, our highways, our schools, and our government buildings. These are good jobs, union jobs, that will get people back to work. Try to establish vocational schools again to train Americans on trades. I think Elon Musk has said a couple of times, stop sending him engineers and start sending him welders. But get us a kick in the pants in the quest for Mars. We're working as hard as a nation to do it now. So fund innovation, the science and the ideas, but give tax breaks to the actual manufacturing. Let the corporations foot the bill and reap the rewards of the explorations, but don't make taxpayers pay for the trial and error. That's the whole point of capitalism. Pass our trade agreements, but use the new fear the world has you, more or less terrified of, that you'll shut them down to refine them to better serve our interests. Make the TPP more agriculture-friendly for the U.S. Pass a U.S.-UK free trade agreement and make it 100% duty-free across all categories and all harmonized tariff codes. Go one step further and allow technology-associated employees to work in the U.S. if they're here from the U.K. without a visa. Many Americans like your wife, but many, many more adore your daughter, Ivanka. Lean on her for advice. Use her as a surrogate and don't shy away from her counsel so often that you can't soften your image by letting the world see the father she says you have been to her. Never, ever, ever use Twitter again. Stop giving off-the-cuff public comments again. It makes you sound like a complete jackass. Never call world leaders names. To put it plainly, try acting like an adult for a change. If you guys actually do try to repeal and replace Obamacare, make certain that what you replace it with is rock solid. You have the benefit of years of tinkering and data to understand that millions of Americans count on this benefit now. Your actions should be rooted in keeping people covered at a fair price. That's something that you said again and again during the election process. Well, come through. Build a cabinet of outsiders backed by a staff of insiders. Not a single one of your senior staff should be a DC insider. You said you were going to drain the swamp, but it appears you've gone in the exact opposite direction. Yes, you brought people in from the business side to do things, but the more and more we look at your cabinet, the more it begins to become clear to us. It seems like you brought the alligators, these apex predators, into the swamp. Call out corruption. Expose evil deeds at the taxpayer's expense and cut waste. Please put your holdings into a blind trust. The more you dance around it, the more you say that it's really not some sort of conflict of interest because you're the president, the more it makes all of us think that you're up to something. It's just going to take one moment, one slip up, one tiny thing for them to all think that it's another Watergate. Remember, like I said earlier, the whole world's watching you. And pardon Hillary. Just do it already. End the distractions, end the madness. Will the hardcore right-wingers get mad? Sure, but I mean, you're a fucking Democrat anyway. Can't wait for everyone to realize that one. The senator will appreciate it. Just let her know. She and her husband are done. If she ever shows her face in D.C. again ever, you'll torture. Avoid the intense compulsion to bomb everyone and everything that gets your attention. Instead, build a coalition with Russia, the U.K., and a few Muslim nations willing to go with us in order to clean up ISIS. It's not that crazy of an idea, but mostly, please just settle the fuck down and do what you do best, make deals. Compromise with people who want to see this country succeed. Most of us are in the middle of the spectrum. Just be sensible in the end. You can do it. You can also fail spectacularly. It's sort of up to you in that haircut of yours, but good luck. I mean, it's not like you're the most powerful person in the world and the whole world's watching. Well, with that, we're going to be moving on to our guests, and I'm pretty excited to have two friends of mine that know a thing or two about local politics in a rural area, know a lot about politics to begin with. Whit Robinson is the town attorney for Warrenton, Virginia. He is also a practicing attorney who focuses on any number of issues, and in the past, he was a lobbyist, a very good one. So you will not be short of opinions. And Sean Polster is a member of the town council of Warrenton. Both of these men are very good friends of mine and have tremendous opinions. And so I hope you're welcome to the podcast. And without further ado, it's time to get to it and decide whether or not what you think is right. So let's hit it and get to this second half of That's What You Think, the podcast. All right. So welcome, everyone, to the inaugural edition of my podcast, which should be terrifying to consider that I now have a mouthpiece to the masses for all of my absurd ideas. And I'm pretty fired up to have a conversation with two good friends of mine about a topic that is never boring, which is politics. So I have the great honor of introducing two people that I spend a great deal of time talking about politics, both local and national. And what's hysterical to me right now is that Sean is looking down at notes because he is exceptionally prepared for this conversation. He has done research. He has taken the time to probably go online. You were that student, weren't you?
I was.
You were the guy that went to the library.
Very analytical, very research driven.
Oh, that's so adorable. And then Whit, on the other hand,
winging it,
is ready to just sling it, which I think is fantastic. So with me today is Whit Robinson. Whit is the not only the town attorney for the town of Warrenton, he is also in private practice. He focuses on all kinds of different areas of legal practice. And Whit has been a friend of mine for a very long time. A very, very long
since
time.
Since back to the Maritime Academy.
Yeah, back to the Maritime Academy. So we've been friends since the early 90s. We've known each other a very long time. And Whit and I have had a very interesting political relationship in that we are both conservatives, but don't always necessarily agree on the same things, but usually fall on the same side of the coin of the big ones. Now, Sean and I actually got to know each other because of social media and began, I guess, chatting on social media because of Whit. And then as I began coming down to Virginia for social stuff, I got to know Sean. He's a great guy. So Sean is a councilman at large here in Warrenton, Virginia, and very, very involved in his local community. And the reason I asked you guys to come on today is I don't know if you're aware of this. You recently had an election. I don't know if you read about this at all.
Where?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a presidential election that kind of got people a little fired up. And a lot of things that came out of that election, Some of them were downright hysterical. I mean, just as a point I need to bring out, there was a period where Wit and I were not conversing on social media. Wit shut me out like I had turned him down on prom night.
I did not unfriend. I don't unfriend people for those. I just unfollow people.
You unfollowed me. So he managed to find a way to get me out of his life for a period of time on Facebook.
But I just need to figure out how to unfollow in real life.
In real life, true. So he got me out of his life on Facebook because I was putting up too much stuff that was frustrating and annoying to him. So I think that's one of the things that came out of the election for me was how contentious it got. There was this never-ending social argument amongst people that I had never gone through that before. I think in the last election for President Obama, even though all of us were on Facebook, I don't think it got that nasty. Mm-hmm. And this last one was straight up revoltingly nasty. And what came out of the argument for me post-election was this feeling of us against them. And the reason that I wanted to have this podcast today specifically with you two guys is two big issues. The first is I have a feeling, a very deep-seated feeling, since I've moved to Virginia, and thank you for accepting me in your community, like inviting a vampire in. You know, now that I'm in, you can never get rid of me. Warrenton and Northern Virginia is very different from living in a city to me where I could be invisible. And we talked about this, Sean. We talked about this on our way to our meat coma the other day. You cannot be invisible here. You can try very hard in a small town to be invisible. They won't let you.
No.
Yeah, you can try very hard. But in a big city, that's everybody was. Nobody got involved. And people that did get involved, you sort of shunned them. You got away from them. But I live in a town now where, you know, my church is an important part of my social structure. The Boy Scouts matter. Town councils matter. Everyone knows local politicians.
Youth sports
absolutely matters. They're like local celebrities. And that hasn't been the case in the past for me. And it really leads me to believe that one of the reasons that President Trump won was this massive difference between what's important to smaller communities as opposed to what's important to larger ones. And because you're two guys that represent a smaller community, that's why I had you in today. And the second part of why what that leads into is the conversation about Electoral College and the all the madness that went on of don't if you have a vote, don't vote for Trump. If we need to go to a real democracy where we vote, one vote counts for one person. And that's really what the base of today's conversation is. So thanks for coming on. It's probably the longest introduction in the history of podcasts. But how does the election cycle work in this town? How often do you have to go up for re-election, Sean?
At-large members are every 4 years. Well, all council members serve a 4-year term, and it alternates. So every 2 years, you'll elect two at-large members and a mayor. And then 2 years later, you'll elect the other 5 ward representatives for the town council.
Got it. Okay.
But in Virginia, the local elections for towns are off cycle. They're in May. They're not in the normal November elections. And so Virginia, as well as the local elections, I think most of that was done as a result of the old Byrd machine in Virginia, which they did not want national elections to be on the same cycle as state and local elections. So you could differentiate between all of them.
Why are elections so hard as far as the logistics behind them? Because that makes sense to me. It would make sense to have local elections at a different time because it spreads out the responsibility to parties and to towns. It probably makes it easier on the town to, or maybe it doesn't, I don't know.
Well, the difficulty with it is if you're not really into politics, you're constantly barraged with politics year-round in Virginia. But if you're a political junkie, which most Virginians can be because of our proximity to D.C., it's a heaven.
Yeah, it's never-ending, right?
But not just that. It's an additional expense to the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Because being off-cycle elections means you need to pay twice for the election machines, for all the election officials to be set up for a May election.
Right.
So there's also a downside to it as well.
Yeah. Well, and I apologize for the background noises. We're actually in Witt's office, and downstairs, I think I don't know what they're doing. I don't know if there's like a controlled explosion or what's happening down there. But yeah, all that pounding you hear, that's not me stamping my foot on the ground like Mr. Ed. That's someone smacking something down there. So in case you haven't noticed, the level of professionalism of my podcast is going to remain incredibly low. And I really don't care unless someone comes in here and takes over responsibility for it. This is about as professional as it's going to get. You know, the whole small town thing. I went to high school in Manchester, New Hampshire. Live free or die. 603 for life. Okay. And before that, I lived in Texas. And for me, I had no concept of cool. I grew up in a demographically uneven, my whole life. I grew up in West Texas where everybody was Caucasian and Baptist. And I moved to New Hampshire where everybody was French Canadian and Caucasian and Catholic. And we all listened to the same music at the same radio stations. We ate the same food. We dressed the same until cable TV really exposed us to the outside world. And my whole life, there was this attitude that small towns were, you guys are a bunch of hicks and local yokels and you had a small way of thinking and everything you did was small. But you can't say that with a straight face. And even saying that back then was small-minded and ridiculous. I mean, we have this argument all the time that people assume that just because you come from the South or you come from a small town that you're small-minded, and you're bigoted, you're racist. And I think that's absolutely awful to begin with, to make that kind of assumption. But more importantly, I think that attitude should be changing because of our access to information, because of the answer to every question is sitting on your phone in your pocket. If you want to get to it, there's no excuses for that anymore. And I,
which is good and bad. I mean, it's good because you always have information, but at the same time, it's bad because you're constantly barraged with information. And it's the second time you use that word, but you're constantly hit with information, which sometimes may not necessarily be true.
All this information.
That's also one of the things that was polarizing about this election. You couldn't turn anywhere and not see something about the election, whether it was social media, whether it was TV, whether it was newsprint. And this election, unlike many previous, I think that's why it was so polarized. There was so much information out there, albeit some of it was false, and we're dealing with that now on social media. There was so much information that what do you digest? What do you have time to digest? I mean, it's information overload.
Yeah. And it hasn't ended.
No.
It's still going on. Yesterday, I was flying home from Dallas. I turned on Fox News on my phone, and the lead story is that Hillary Clinton apparently put her password in a couple of her emails. Her actual passwords were in some of her emails that the FBI has uncovered. It hasn't ended. We're in the middle, we're a week away from the inauguration. We're still talking about the leaks prior to election. We're still talking about Russian hacking, you know. The Russians hacked my podcast. We're still talking about the hacking and everything that went along with all of that's gone with it. People are still protesting in the streets. People are still whining and complaining about what went on that election. It has not ended. I can't go on Facebook and scroll through more than four or five people without someone telling me that they're going to stand defiant in the face of this awful new administration. They haven't done anything. There's nothing to say it's awful and defiant against. There's this... And I can remember it, okay? I'll be the first to admit, I remember when Obama got elected the first time. I was terrified that somebody was going to land a helicopter on my roof and steal my guns and suddenly tell me I couldn't go to church anymore. I'm being facetious. But over eight year period, I was constantly worried about my Second Amendment rights. I was worried about my First Amendment rights. I was worried about, as a libertarian, all the things that I hold dear. And in the end, how bad was it? I got taxed to high holy, you know, hell. But did anything really change to me? That's an argument we could have some other time. I don't know. But maybe the liberals are going through that same fear. And maybe they're better at whining and complaining than we are. But it's kind of where I'm at. So I agree with you. It's so contentious. It was everywhere. It hasn't gone away yet.
But the good side of it, though, is that when was the last time? I mean, everybody got a civics lesson over the last month that you can't believe over... What? The Electoral College. I mean, how many kids, how many millennials out there even knew what an Electoral College was until this election?
How many adults didn't realize that we had one?
Yeah.
Honestly, how many people were going out there and thinking, well, my vote doesn't count? And that's just something that was stuck in their head. They didn't realize that they were part of a much larger machine. So Electoral College, when you look at that map, it is astounding. When you take a look at that map and you see where the blue is versus the red, and it kind of leads into that rural versus urban argument, what we care about in a farming community, as an example, is very different, or a fishing community, like I lived in Massachusetts, it's very different than someone who works in a hedge fund in New York. And what are the things that people care about more than? What are the, if you were to say, outside of the big national things like counterterrorism and let's say the economy,
Warrington, Warrington's quality of life. I mean, 63% of our population commutes. So they go into Fairfax, they go into Arlington, they go into Alexandria, into D.C., but they come here because the quality of life is why people are in Warrington and Fauquier County.
So that's why they commute so far.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And while we're a small town, we're not the typical small town that you'd find in Alabama or anywhere else. I mean, we have a close proximity to a metropolitan city that is very diverse and unique given the fact that it's the nation's capital. But we still like the fact that it's a small town, but if you want to go down to the Kennedy Center, you know, just a short trip down the road.
Well, it's like I've got the Warrington Tourism Board sitting in the office.
There's a reason that Sean's here and that I, even though I grew up here, I stayed here. Right. It's a great place to raise a family.
That's another part of it as well. And if you look at where do young people go after college, do they go back to small communities? No, they go to big cities. And people that are unmarried, do they go to suburbs? No, they're living in big cities. And what they think of politically is important to them is very different. Do they worry about school boards? Do they worry about funding schools? Do they worry about funding roads? Do they worry about commuting back and forth? No, because they already live where the jobs are. And things like farm subsidies and what we worry about protecting wetlands and environments, which believe it or not, yes, conservatives in the suburbs care a great deal about the environment. Our attitudes about it are very different, I think, than people in larger communities. Go ahead.
To your point of the kids leaving all the metropolitan areas, that's what we have here in Fauquier County and Warrington. Kids graduate high school 18 years old, and you see the drop of that age gap. And they come back in their 50s with their family back to Warrington, back to Fauquier to live here, again for that quality of life. So we see the age spike again go up of our demographics here in town. And that's an interesting point, is the kids leave out of high school, they go to the metropolitan areas and they come back for the quality of life.
And they want something in these suburbs, and they have a life and an expectation. And politically, that is important. And politically, that's what politics comes down to. It's always personal. Where are you at in your life? What do you want in your life? And we were just talking a minute ago, right? As a politician, your message needs to not be about me, me, me all the time. It's about them, them, them. Because that's the constituency want. They want to understand what you're doing for them. They want to feel like you really are a representative for them and you really are out there doing what's right for the people that you represent.
And I say that all the time. When I vote on council, it's not my vote.
It's their vote.
Right, correct. It's their vote. It's the citizens' vote. Mm-hmm. And you have to realize that as an elected official.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So, you know, back to the Slick Toll College bit, the differences between the two radically. And the use of the Electoral College as a tool to win the presidency. When I stayed up all night and they started breaking it down from county to county, and maybe we can get the gerrymandering if you want to, from county to county, the way that they pinpointed specific areas of Ohio, of Pennsylvania, of Michigan, and guys that voted, women, men and women that voted for Trump, that had been Democrats, that flipped. They reminded me of the kind of Democrats that my parents and friends of my parents were, that were Union Democrats. They were sort of that blue collar Democrat.
Reagan Democrats.
They wanted jobs back. They were in the lower middle class. They were trying to get lifted out of that. And that was a message that resonated so deeply. Immigration, job creation, stop the exports, free trade agreements, lower taxes on the middle class. It really hit a home run. And it got them to come out and vote. And I think because people weren't excited about voting on the other hand, It stopped them. There wasn't that excitement about voting on the other side of the aisle that you would imagine that there would have been. It was incredibly effective as a tool to get that guy elected. It was amazing.
Well, and I think the difference is a lot of people will still contend, and which is true. You know, obviously that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and Trump only won the Electoral College. Well, in the end, what matters? The Electoral College. Right. And as Trump said, I'm not a shill for Trump by any stretch of the imagination, but as Trump said, this is the playbook. This is, you know, these are the rules. Tell me what the rules are and I'll play by them. Now, whatever he does in his private life with his business is a different story, but right. I'm talking specifically about the campaign. He said, what are the rules? And these are the rules I'm going to play by, and this is the strategy I'm going to take based on these rules. And as he said, if there was an Electoral College and it was a popular vote, I'd have focused on the cities, and in which, you know, you listen to them and their internal pollings, and they understood where they were going and what they were doing. And I think if the Democrats, not that any Democrats will listen to me, but if they were going to step back, and I think Joe Biden was the one that talked about it the most, who said, we have to step back and look at ourselves as opposed to necessarily blaming everybody else, which you can still do. But you've got to take a look at what are our future strategies going to be. I know a lot of people talk about, well, we need to get rid of the Electoral College. I don't know whether that's necessarily the best case, but you can certainly always look at, review, and shift and adjust some things. I tend to not necessarily be that way when it comes to the Constitution as a strict constitutionalist. But at least you can take a look at, okay, what are the rules for the playbook? And that's essentially my view on the Electoral College. Again, it's for smarter minds than me to make those changes if they want to shift and change them. But
yeah, I don't know if I buy that.
But at the same time, it's worked pretty darn well for the last 250 some odd years.
So. A lot of people disagree with you right now. I mean, there's a lot of people marching in the street that would, they want to burn Trump in effigy. They want to burn down the Electoral College.
But you know what? In the end, as you said, death and destruction was going to follow
President Obama.
Clinton. Death and destruction was going to follow George W. Death and destruction was going to follow Obama. Now death and destruction is going to follow Trump. In the end, you got to have faith in our country.
If we can survive Nixon, we can survive anything.
I mean, we've survived civil wars. We've survived world wars. This country's, not to be a shill for the country too, but it's the greatest country on earth. And we'll survive. We'll survive Trump. We'll survive everything else because of the American people.
I guess 2 points to what you're saying is, how do you measure success? Uh-huh. So this Electoral College has been in place now for 214 years.
Right.
Only 5 times has the person that not won the popular vote won the Electoral College. But only twice has it gone to the House for a tie.
Why did I know that?
Yep, Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams.
He's pulling out his notes.
Well, I came prepared. Yeah, I'm sorry for that. Yeah, yeah. But let me flip this. Okay, so say that Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams.
Okay, those are 2 heavy hitters.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, in theory, the system works. So how do you measure success? In 214 years, it's only gone to the House twice. And only 5 times has the popular vote person not been elected president by Electoral College. I mean, what are we measuring success on? But not just that. If you want to say, okay, well, the popular vote shouldn't have been there in a constitutional convention, it should have just been popular. Abraham Lincoln would have never been elected. He only won 39% of the popular vote. So what would our nation look like today if he wasn't president?
Well, we'd have a different looking $5 bill.
But no, I mean, you can what if it to death, but looking at history, how do we measure success? Is the system working? So as a process,
Back it up. What are we trying to achieve? What is the Electoral College trying to achieve? I don't think we talk enough about that. What tyranny is it trying to control? Is it trying to control keeping large population areas from taking over the decision on who the president is? A position which admittedly has limited power. Because I would argue that if I was going to make that argument, that going to a direct one vote, take out the Electoral College, does not deny the safety to the populace because our congressmen and our senators still make the laws. The president just signs
it. And this all goes back to division of power.
Right.
And that's why our forefathers did that. I mean, we're in a federalist system.
Right.
I mean, it's not a democracy. Yeah. It's a republic. And so when you look at it, that's why, certain powers are given to the state. And long time ago, the electorals, I mean, your senators were elected by your state representatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't until later that the Constitution was amended to where the people elect them. Mm-hmm. But the electorals are still representatives of the state, which therein drives states have the power. I mean, that's how our Constitution is driven.
Right.
So, go ahead.
No, it's meant to be that way, and you're right. It's not as though the president gets to run everything. We don't have a monarchy. However, the president does have a significant amount of power.
And it seems to just be getting more and more.
And it does, and certainly through the executive orders, which are getting to be worse and worse. Not just Obama, George W. Bush had an extraordinary amount of executive orders, which essentially take the effect of law, which I'm not a big fan of executive orders. I'm not a big fan of the CFRs either. I mean, that's a bunch of rules written by GS-14s, and I apologize to the GS-14s that live in this area. But it's essentially those CFRs are treated as law, but yet they're not necessarily debated heavily in Congress. And so I have issues with those. But again, the forefathers designed gridlock. And everybody says, well, we hate gridlock. Sometimes gridlock isn't bad, especially if you're on if you're on the losing end of a popular vote, because you don't want sweeping change all at once. The forefathers really wanted debate. They didn't want somebody to come in, you know, take up the scepter and start making orders and demanding that everybody follow their lead. They wanted debate. They didn't want a king. They wanted people to discuss issues and say, you know what, while you may have a good idea there, let's really take a close, hard look at it because I disagree with these aspects of it. And so instead of just saying, yeah, that's a good idea, rubber stamp it, move on, it's now let's study it, let's deal with it. It's a deliberative body as opposed to a military body, which is, you know, direct command.
Yeah. And you have to look at history. I mean, look how they were ruled. And they said, listen, we don't, you talk about tyranny, that's not how we want to live. We want a Republican form of government. When I say Republican, I'm not talking about a party. Yeah. It's a Republican form of government by the people, for the people. And so that's why they set this deliberative process up.
And to me, the Electoral College forces that debate. Why? Because if you look at that electoral map, it really does speak volumes. Because if you look at the electoral map and you see the population centers are the places where people get the most votes, and certainly in the popular vote nationwide, the focus then is going to be solely on what are urban areas' needs, as opposed to what are the rural area needs. And by having the Electoral College, you force a debate and a discussion about other needs, other viewpoints. And I don't think a debate about different viewpoints is a bad thing.
I don't think it is either, but do we really have conversations and discourse as a country anymore?
Sure.
I don't know if we do, Whit.
All you got to do is hop on Facebook or hop on the cable news networks.
Those are not conversations and discourse. That, for the most part, that is zealots barking at each other.
But out of those, and this is the lawyer in me, is that out of zealots barking at each other, and in the legal world, two lawyers, the theory behind the legal world is you have two advocates for one for each side that will argue wholeheartedly against each other, and somewhere out of that will come the truth. And so if you have the zealots arguing one side versus the other, you know, whether it's 10% of the far right versus 10% of the left, somewhere in the middle, you'll have some kind of an actual discourse. People listening, people hearing different viewpoints. I think it gets to a nasty personal level, but it's certainly, and everybody says, oh, it's gotten worse and worse and worse. Go back and read some of the pamphlets that they used to write about each other back in the 1700s. They were nasty. And so that stuff I don't agree with. However, that zealot argument, when I had friends of mine who are, you know, on the far left arguing on my Facebook page where the guys are on the far right, sometimes I feel it's humorous. I tend to think Facebook is more for humor than anything else. But on occasion, I actually kind of enjoy watching it. It's not, as long as it doesn't get personal. I don't mind it when people actually have those tough arguments with each other, different viewpoints, so long as at the end of the day, you can have a beer with each other. And that's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. It's bad if you're silenced. It's bad if your advocates are silenced and you're forced to follow one way. Sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, it's a good soapbox.
But to me, that's why the Electoral College is there, and it's a very important part of it. And today, it was not today, but this election was a good example of it, where there was a lot of vitriol out there and there was a lot of misinformation. But again, that's been the case. Everybody thinks it's new. It's not. It's been around for a long time. But that it's an important part of society. It's an important part of a democracy or a republic.
And I believe this election cycle, what we saw in the media, what we saw on social media, the negative information that was out there is exactly why our forefathers developed the Electoral College. They were afraid of a tyranny of a few. They were afraid that a few people would disseminate amongst the colony the wrong message and not getting the information. If you look at the information that was put out there, wherever it was, a lot of it had nothing to do with what the issues of the election really were. They were personally driven messages against another candidate on whichever side it was. Yes, I have a quote. I know, shocking, right? So this is Delegate Jerry. This is at the Constitutional Convention, July 25th, 1787.
If you weren't so big, I would give you a wedgie right now.
So just listen to this for a second. The ignorance of the people would put in the power of some one set of men dispersed through the Union and acting in concert to delude them into any appointment. I mean, think about what happened during this election cycle and the information and misinformation that was put out there, whether it was one side or the other. I mean, not knowing, now we know the whole false media. So this is the reason why the Electoral College is there.
And one side doesn't own the false information that went out.
Well, no. I'm not saying that. Yeah. I'm just saying, once again, a lot of the information that was put out there was personal and negative. It didn't deal with the issues. And I think in the election, you know, one of the things that I know here in town, I try to focus on are the issues. You know, in a small town, everything is personal.
Right.
But at some point in time, once again, you represent the people. And so you have to represent the issues of them. And I feel that that was very light, whether it was in a debate, whether it was in a discussion during this election. We didn't hear a lot about the issues.
We've got to be coming up on, what year was Gary Hart? 87 maybe?
He was primary Clinton first.
No, he's primary against Reagan. 1988, right? Yeah. So, it was Bush, right? Monkey business with...
With the boat, yeah.
Yeah, oh, God, now I can't remember names. This is why I need a producer. I need some teenager with, like, lightning-fast typing skills to do, work Google for me over in the corner. Who's like, no, Pete, it was actually 1988, you moron.
What do you think Sean's doing right now?
Exactly.
Hey, I got it. I mean, that's, you know...
It's Sean's got his gigantic hands over there, like...
I got you, yeah.
What was the woman's name that was...
Extramarital affair?
Yeah. It was a Jennifer Flowers,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you go back to the 80s in 1988. I mean, so we're coming up on a huge anniversary then. He got brought down by an extramarital affair. And there was a period before that where I don't think anybody would have said a word about it. But in a political sense, ever since then, what someone...
Donna Rice.
Jennifer Flowers was Clinton, right?
Clinton.
So ever since then, you know, who someone is personally, what the character is, a massive part of it. But it seems like with Trump, we've kind of swung in the other direction where we've hired someone. You know, I've worked for some people that I didn't necessarily have a lot of respect for as individuals, but as a professional, like, that's the guy. You know, I might not think very much of him as a moral figure, but when it came time to punch into the clock, I got his job and he was incredible. And I didn't worry about his moral character. Politics has always been a different thing altogether, where people have said, you know, what he says in public, what he does, and all the rest of it. And I know you guys probably don't want to comment on that, but when I think about it all these years later, on a national scale, there were people who simply did not care. They were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, either based on party, based on gender, or based on just an utter disgust of who she was running against. Same side of the argument. There were people who were going to vote for Donald Trump based on party, based on gender, based on an utter disgust of who he was running against, a combination of those.
Based on passions.
And there were people who were voting on issues on both sides as well, or a mixture of all of those things. And passions, like you said. And I'm a big believer, you never win an argument based on data, ever, because arguments start based on passion and they end based on passion. In a small town, that's probably even worse. I'm sure that everybody's in everybody's business. Everyone knows everything about each other. The Electoral College and the way that it was set up, the way that it works, the way that it's put out there, it dilutes that, I think. I think that it forces everyone's opinion of what's more important. Is it someone's background? Is it someone's opinions? Is it someone's policy? Is it their experience? It makes it not necessarily upfront, gives everyone's reason for voting, makes it a little less important.
Everybody keeps saying that, you know, politics today is nastier than it was before, and it was pretty nasty all
nasty.
The way through. It really has.
Go back to the Roman Senate when they stabbed, Caesar in the middle of the Senate. That was
pretty
nasty.
And the rumor mills, the cloak rooms, all you got to do is go back and look at the courts in France and Britain. I mean, the rumor mills and the gossip.
Sure.
That's always been there. It's just, it's different now. Because you've got such widespread communication, 24-hour news cycle. You've got, the average peasant back in Louis XIV day didn't have an opportunity, to stand up in court and call somebody out.
They also couldn't read.
But what they did was they could stand outside a gate, and once they finally got together,
Behead some people.
Behead some people. Yeah. But the point is that it wasn't something that happened 24/7. 7 days a week. It just, now it's just constantly in your face. And so sometimes you got to throttle back, but it's not new. There's nothing, as somebody once told me, there's nothing that this generation has done that is new in terms of theory or social.
Or outrage.
I mean, technology's new, but all the stuff that's going on now, it's been around, and it will always be around. And it's just the way it is.
I get frustrated with this argument that the technology drove the argument. I think technology is breaking the argument. I think it's, I can sit behind my keyboard and I can be a complete, I put myself in an echo chamber. I can block everyone and get rid of everyone and only hear the things I want to hear if I wanted to. I could take myself completely out of debate if I wanted to. I could see everyone else's opinion and I could not be involved. I could start arguments by saying really incendiary things, which I will admit, because I'm an awful human being, I have done. I have gone on other people's pages and I put things up there just to be a jerk and to get things going. And I can also, I can just argue for arguing's sake. You know, I put something on Facebook the other day. I had a very good friend of mine, a friend of mine from Harvard.
Yes, because I went to Harvard.
Who?
The first time he has said that, this podcast. I think, what's the time?
Well, it should be mentioned because it makes me superior in all ways. I have a friend of mine from Harvard who said to me, you know, Pete, it's important to remember that you were given an open mind for a reason so you could have your mind change every once in a while. When's the last time you changed your mind about anything? And it drove me because I wanted to look at him and give him an answer. Like, listen, here's where I changed my mind. I couldn't do it. I could not remember the last time that I had a closely held belief change. And I felt like my old angry Sicilian grandfather. It bothered me.
It's
really
a function of age, though, too.
I mean,
when you're younger, you're more passionate. When you get, as you get older, your life experiences tend to tamp down some of those things. But at the same time, you can still be passionate every once in a while about certain things. But I'm certainly not as passionate as I once was.
I don't want to believe I'm unmovable. I'm a much softer person since I've had children than I was before I had children. I'm a much softer person after getting divorced. I'm a much softer person now that I'm a partner someplace and I have a bunch of employees and I'm a business owner. I am a much softer person. I'm a harder person too. When it comes to my children, when it comes to my business, when it comes to my home, when it comes to my family, my fiance, I am a much harder person than I ever was before. So, but I just think about personally, right? I'm the same jerk about guns as I was when I was 18 and walked into Riley's gun store in New Hampshire and bought a shotgun, a ski mask, and a box of ammo at the same time on my birthday. You know, I'm just as much of a, I feel like a zealot. And Facebook in this election, I don't think anybody changed. I don't think I know a single person who was like, I was going to vote for Hillary Clinton until I went on so-and-so's message board and said, hey, you know what? Now I'm all about Trump. Or, you know what, Pete, your never-ending babble about that forgetful stoned moron Gary Johnson made me decide I was going to vote for the Libertarian Party instead. I don't think a single person ever said anything like that. So what are we really doing other than going on social media and being just brutal to each other? Because you're a professional politician. You're a professional politician. I do not believe that that is what happens behind closed doors. You come to consensus. You have conversations and you look for ways to make things work because that's in the best interest of your constituency. We're not doing that. We're having these self-interested arguments in an echo chamber where, you know, we do everything we can to be right. That's all it is. We're looking for excuses to prove ourselves right.
Or to justify ourselves or justify our beliefs. But if you sit in that echo chamber too long, it just is going to drive you nuts every time you walk outside and listen to somebody else's viewpoint.
I was in front of a 14-year-old young lady who may or may not be my daughter. And I was having a conversation with her where she was convinced that she was right. And I was convinced that she was wrong because I happen to have, you know, 30 more years of experience walking this hurtling rock than she does. And she was convinced I was dead wrong. And here I am, you know, barking at her about what she needs to do versus what she thinks she needs to do. And it felt like I was on Facebook having an argument against someone about whatever issue. She was not going to change her mind. And is what it's come to?
But this is also one of the things that the technology society has done. It has driven us away from having a face-to-face conversation.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Having a personal conversation and be able to look at somebody, see their body language, see where they're coming from, it's more easy. I think it's easier, to see a middle or find a middle ground. To whereas we have people now that are texting their wives, I want a divorce.
Absolutely.
You know, so there isn't that communication. So we've lost the ability of interpersonal communication. And you see that on Facebook. Do you think some of the comments made on Facebook, anybody would ever say to your face?
Never.
So, again, you're hiding behind it.
Well,
so we've lost.
No, you're absolutely right, Sean. You're right.
So, and this election provided an opportunity for people to hide behind a screen name. Yes, sure, everybody sees it, but it's not as personal as me standing up on a dais or me standing in front of you saying those incendiary remarks.
But even still, Sean, I still say some things never change. The technology changes.
Sure.
It all remains the same. And to your point, people would never say that to your face, but technology has allowed us to do that. Well, that's true to a degree, but at the same time, guess who was using pseudonyms? I mean, you want to go back to the Federalist Papers? One name.
Yeah.
Written by a bunch of different people.
Yeah.
People were afraid to say those things and put their name to it. To this day, you sit on a blog and you get people that will use a pseudonym and hide behind a pseudonym and say, you know, awful things about people they would never say publicly or to their face. But you know what? It's not new.
No.
It's been going on for a long, long time. And the arguments about the Electoral College, I'm sure were being argued way back when. You know, these things aren't new. It's just the way they're discussed is changed.
And that goes back to the forefathers. I mean, they distrusted the passions of the people.
They hated each other.
Right. And so, but that's how the Electoral College came to fruition. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look at this election, it was polarizing because you may not have voted for a candidate, not because of party, but because you hated that person. It was a passion. It had nothing to do with values or views like you talked about. It was merely a hatred for that individual. Can you remember another election where people didn't vote for a candidate because they just hated that person?
I can't. And there's a lot of people that would say to me, well, it's what happened with Obama because of the color of his skin. I'm like, well, hold on, back up. That is a really childish thing to say. And I've been a crusader about this particular issue and I've got a lot of friends who are going to listen to this, and I'm not going to apologize for what I'm about to say, but this Northeastern attitude that's basically...
This is the point where Sean and I cringe.
Yeah. Hey, and these opinions are my own. But pretty much every friend of mine north of Delaware who is a liberal friend of mine who loves to say that everyone that voted for Donald Trump is a racist and a misogynist and a sexist and a bigot of one format or another. And that is just such a childish thing to say. And the fact that we're at a point now in our dialogue, and that's why I did this podcast, is we need to start creating dialogues. And it's kind of awful that the first one I had, I'm having it with two other conservatives, but you know, whatever. Feel free to just trash me right there. But we don't have dialogues anymore where we can be honest with each other because we're afraid to have face-to-face conversations. Because we're actually, you know what? We're afraid to have passionate disagreements. Because we don't want to be un-PC or we don't want to hurt someone else's feelings. And I think we're also afraid to be real and honest with one another. I'm a big believer in this. We have lost intimacy as a society. We don't know each other anymore. And you know, going back to my original point about living in a small town, one of the things you can't get away from is knowing each other. You do know one another here. When I lived in the north end of Boston, I couldn't help but know everybody because I had family everywhere. And when you know you're Italian American living in the north end of Boston, everybody's in your business. And in Virginia, moving here, I live in a small community of a small neighborhood. I go to a small church. My kids go to a relatively big school, but we're very involved. Everyone knows what our cars are, who we are, what we look like, who our kids are. We're at everything. We're involved in everything. I happen to have two friends that are involved in town government. You know that I have other friends that are involved in town government. Like it or not, I'm part of it. So I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. I don't want to embarrass you two. Think about that. For the first time in my life, the most offensive person probably anyone knows, I worry about driving around in my car and flipping somebody the bird out the window because I want to come back on the two of you. Think about that, right? I actually care enough about the two of you that I worry about the things I do in public. I don't worry about, you know, making Amy upset, right? Yeah. I worry about making you two upset. And when you drive around with her license plates, you know, you should worry too. Now, when Facebook gives you this medium, I have friends say to me all the time, it should be so easy to get your political views out on Facebook as a candidate. It should be so easy. Why didn't Hillary Clinton do a better job? Look at what Bernie Sanders did, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's easy to get your opinion out there. It's also easy to start this viper pit and shark feeding frenzy of hatred. And people will, if it was one vote, I honestly believe this, if it was one vote and there was no Electoral College, I personally believe fewer people would vote. I think that the party system would be even more powerful than it currently is. And I think that local politics would lose the trade-off of having the party send more money and more influence in local elections at times when it's important. I think there's something to be said about that as well. And we all know my opinion and my deep hatred for the two-party system in America. There'll be another podcast when Whit and I will actually, you know, cover ourselves in bear grease and beat each other on the floor of his, actually probably there'll be blood. There could be some lost teeth over that one. But I'm not so certain. I don't believe in a one person, one vote. In this day and age, in a modern day and age, when we're talking about a political system, don't get angry when I say this, because I know you both love the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, and being an Alexander Hamilton economist living amongst you Jeffersonians makes me want to retch every day. Why do we still need a president?
Well, easy. You got to have a commander-in-chief.
Why? We have generals for that. We have someone who's in charge.
Well, it fulfills the three-party system. Once again, it's the balance of government. It's the derivative of the federal system, legislative. I mean, it goes back to that principle that you have checks and balances.
Why can't we have a prime minister based on who wins the party in Congress?
Because you have to have an administration actually run things. If you actually had Congress or the judiciary run things?
They have one in Canada. They have one in the United Kingdom. Why couldn't we have one here?
Really? You're going to compare us to America's really, national park, really? Canada?
I think Whit just threw up in his mouth a little bit there. Here's my argument. It's 2017. If I can vote for American Idol on my phone, I can't vote for the president on my phone. Yeah, I know. It's gotten a little loud in here. Yeah. It's 2017. We basically just elected a reality television star to the presidency of the United States because he was the one person who was willing to stand up and do it.
So we also elected a B actor at one point. We did.
So again, if you look at the thought that was put into the Electoral College by our forefathers, Article 2, it is larger, it has more information than declaring war, than setting up the judiciary system, and taxation representation. There is more in that one section than in those other three. Think about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of thought. I disagree with you there. But I'm not gonna give up on this part. We live in a modern society that is still being run in many instances and in many cases.
So to go back to your point, if we did that, where would the major votes be cast?
You could do it in all kinds of different ways. You could do it over the internet.
I understand that. But if you went for a one-for-one vote...
Oh, hold on. What's got to go?
I do. Okay. I'm sorry, guys.
Well, we're gonna close this out in a minute anyway.
No, keep going.
No. We don't want to say thanks to Whit, but Whit's going to take off here, but Sean and I are going to talk a little bit longer. Thanks for coming on, Whit.
Goodbye to future self when I listen to this and laugh and hate the sound of my voice.
Well... No reason to hate it.
Well, the last point I want to make, if you do a one-for-one, so a popular vote in the United States, where are your populaces in the United States?
Sure. Yeah, they're all in the big cities.
You can count them. Absolutely. They're your big cities. So are your rural votes counted? Wyoming, for instance, you know, they have one House district and then two senators. Mm-hmm. So their population... How would they get the accurate representation?
Because they would send their congressmen and their senators in who would build coalitions with other people. It forces people to actually work with one another. I don't know where I fall on this entirely, but it makes me wonder about the efficacy of this entire system.
Well, and same thing. I mean, look on the flip side. Look where the money spent during this election.
Yeah.
Was any money spent in rural Virginia?
Probably not.
Was any money spent in rural Iowa, Idaho, Wyoming, any of those states? No. They spent money in the big cities. That's where the populace was. That's where they were trying to get the votes. I feel the Electoral College presents the large cities, the masses, from building up a mindset to where they dictate, again, tyranny, what the rest of the country has. It provides a balance. It goes back to the separation of power.
Yeah, I mean, we keep coming to that.
No, I'm with you.
No. I think...
That's a good discussion, though.
It's a good discussion to have. Maybe I should have brought somebody in here from Brooklyn to sit down and tell us how wrong we were. Maybe that's what I'll learn on my first unprofessional, poorly run podcast with my interviews. It's easy for me to sit here and cast all these, you know, different dispersions on the way the system is put together. And fun, frankly.
But it's a good discussion to have on both sides. I mean, and this is one of the things I think that's great of America is we're allowed to have this discussion.
We
can have this discussion.
We need to, but it's not happening.
Right.
I watch Fox News and I watch Al Jazeera. I used to watch Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera and BBC.
Yeah, and BBC. And I watch those things. But I think that most Americans are probably getting the news from one news source which is probably telling them what they want to hear. I read papers that give me opinions and editorials that I want. I follow things in social media that give me the news stories that kind of back up my opinions to outrage me and to make sure that I get my daily dose of political outrage. A tremendous amount of my political information comes from parties that I follow. It doesn't come from independent sources. I don't even know if there are any independent political sources anymore.
And that's, again, going back to Al Jazeera, BBC, they report the news. I mean, if you look at news sources, something unbiased.
Sure. And what is journalism anymore? You know, when anybody with a camera phone can go out and record something that's happening practically while it's happening and then put it up for mass consumption minutes later, what is journalism? You know, when someone hears a rumor and can put that rumor on the internet and all of a sudden it becomes something someone else has to react to, is that really, honestly, journalism? As opposed to the old days when a newspaper reporter would have a number of sources before they reported on it, they'd make sure they were comfortable enough to put it out there because they didn't want their reputation being ruined. Well, you know, Bobby Stardust 1444 on Yahoo.com doesn't care about his reputation very much. He just wants to put something out there to get clicks. And it's a broken system. It's a broken system. I believe in this country. I believe in Americans. But I think that our consumption of information and, like you said, being a keyboard warrior, God, that is loud. We're going to have to go downstairs and chloroform these guys the next time we do this. I go out to dinner with teenagers and with my youngest, who's 10. And I've got a 13-year-old who's transitioning to a 14-year-old and a 14-year-old who's transitioning to a 25-year-old and a 19-year-old is in college. And the 19-year-old is in college, now that he's been in college for a year, is like a totally different human being. When it comes to politics, you know, he wouldn't be upset if I said this. He voted for Donald Trump, and he's very proud of the fact he voted for Donald Trump. And this is a guy who's generally pretty conservative for a kid who grew up in Minnesota and in New Hampshire. He's pretty conservative. But at the same time, he listens to hip-hop music. He is outrageously socially liberal on a lot of different areas. And he's involved. He's an architecture student. He's involved in the arts. So you would think that he would be a little more liberal, you know? Great interpersonal skills, great social skills. Then I have these two teenagers that have practically lived their entire social life behind a keyboard on a phone. They call their friends up? No. They text their friends constantly. I don't know about you, but when I wanted to talk to my friends, hey, what you doing? I'm going to come over.
You just have to walk down the street.
And I walk down the street. and we would sit there and look each other face to face and we would have conversations. They're uncomfortable having a face-to-face conversation. They're uncomfortable with strangers in particular. If we go to dinner somewhere, the two of them would much rather say to Amy or say to me, hey, listen, this is what I want. Could you order it for me? You know, like she's Mariah Carey or like, you know, he's Kanye and we're their personal assistant. And it's not because they're uptight or snooty. It's because they're just not comfortable talking to a waiter or talking to a stranger. Whereas, you know, when I was a kid, I couldn't wait for the guy to come around because I got a chance to order something. And hopefully my dad would tell me, no, that's not what you're getting. You're getting this. And I think that the more insular these people get, the harder it's going to be on our political environment. Because think about how me-focused that is. You know, how me-focused. And again, to go back, being a politician is not about being me-focused. It's about being we-focused, which seems the exact opposite of what you would.
Well, I tell everybody in town, I'm not a politician, I'm a firefighter. I mean, I come from a profession that you're there to serve the public.
Right.
You know, they call 911 in the darkest times, darkest hour, and you go there and you make the situation better. And that's how I see politics, is we're there to make it better for our constituents and have these conversations, whether it's support of one side, whether it's the other, you know?
I think that would come as a surprise to a lot of, I work with politicians every day. And there seems to be two types of politicians, ones that do see it as a calling and want to help people, and the ones that see it as a way of building a cult of personality and working on their ego. And I think that most Americans would feel that most politicians fall on one side or the other. They don't meet the people that represent them. It's exceedingly rarer and rarer. I have a good friend of mine, Adam, who probably listened to this, that went to Harvard with me. That's like the third time I've mentioned it.
It is.
Yeah. He likes to mention the fact that he couldn't stand Ted Kennedy. But one thing he said about Ted Kennedy was Ted Kennedy called people back. It didn't matter what party you were. Ted Kennedy made sure that people got calls back, that people had their petitions answered, even if it wasn't the answer that they wanted. He got back to people. There was a personal touch. And I think that's missing. And I also, I don't know why on earth anybody would want to be a politician in 2017. And people say me all the time, people want to turn something. I'm unelectable. I would not last a day with everyone out there telling me what I'm doing is wrong and correcting everything I've done. I think it would be crushing to me psychologically after a while. Because I would probably put my own opinion and my own ego before the people I represented, which is again why I'm not a politician. I'm a little too self-serving. So that was not a question, which is why you're probably not talking right now. Anyway, so just to put a bow on it, if you could change anything about the way that we run elections, is there anything you'd change?
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't. You'd keep it all the way it is.
And again, it goes back to, you know, what do you see as success? And, you know, we do have people now that are saying the system's not working, but look at its track record.
Right.
I mean, is it something that can be tweaked, tuned up? Sure. Let's have a conversation. Let's start a discussion. You know, bring your information and I'll bring my information. We'll sit down and we'll try to find a happy medium. But for a process such as this, 214 years, it's got a pretty good track record.
All right. Well, so you're an ain't broke, don't fix it kind of a guy?
Oh, no. I mean, I think if there's a better way to do a process, that we should look at that. Huh? I think you evolve. I mean, and we've done that as a nation. We've changed.
But this process is working. The facts back it up. Right. Well, we are coming up on an hour, and Whit already walked out of here like a scorned lover. So we're gonna hit stop on this. And Sean, I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Thank you.
And for being honest and talking with us. And
great discussion to have.
Yeah, and hopefully I didn't ruin your political career with all of this. And we'll hopefully have you on again to talk about some of the topics.
Sounds great.
Thanks again. And yeah, that'll be it for this session. Thanks.